All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage. New mic, I've got a new mic, and John's got a new mic somewhere as well. And hopefully we're up and running. How are you? We're probably talking about something I probably don't have much experience of. And I forgot what the subject is, John. It might have something to do with society as it is today, and the, well, I would imagine the political structure or the political landscape has changed somewhat, or is changing somewhat, and alternatives and basically us, John.
Yeah, that's a very good summation of a subject that I'm not quite sure where I started writing this, and I'm not quite sure where it went, or even why. So tonight's episode is either going to be, you know, some real philosophical edgelord level of brilliance that this show's never achieved before, or it's just going to be all over the shop. I haven't really decided which, but stay tuned and find out. In my little, you know, provisional titles that I give these shows just to benefit me, I've just kind of put like the state of us in brackets or something. This could be fun. Basically, I want to talk about the dangers of being ruled by a class, or perhaps a mini class, that not only has a stranglehold over our rights and freedoms, but also how this manifests in a dedication to capitalist realism to the point of destruction, and perhaps where this comes from, or the ideas behind this come from. So it's going to be a show about the things that we do and why we do them, and it will be about the results of unchecked power and the people who hold it. So I guess this is as good a place to start as anyway. We live in a society now that completely lacks any real meaningful kind of accountability. The richer that you get, the well-off also fall into this bracket to a greater or lesser degree. But also, it is not merely based on actual material wealth. There is a very ingrained social element too. We are driven by consumer desire and practice, because this is the only thing available to us from cash to credit. And in a world where real political power has been taken away, this and the culture around us becomes the only expression of politics. In times of disharmony such as these, it can be easy to slip into a protectionist mode, riddled with fear that what little you have left can be taken away too, and the experiences of living in a world that has only ever really gotten worse means being inspired to rise up and overcome is pretty difficult. Although, not to make an age thing out of this, it does seem to be something that's slightly more possible for younger people, but we'll get into that later on. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just kind of saying that's the way it is. There is also an underlying social level full of expectation and practice that does not like to be challenged. This is the level that has branded all left-wing thought and action as unacceptable, as a direct threat to all forms of order, etc. You will hear people express this while criticizing any left-wing leader or thinker, or even grassroots group. Some, you know, genuinely left-wing, and some just merely, you know, various forms of progressive, whatever, you know, anything that represents some kind of change to the prevailing order. The fear in their voice as they prattle on about things they don't understand, like public finances, for instance, or claim that these people are stuck in the past somehow, celebrating a 70s style trade union leader or something or another. Pretty ironic for anyone, especially on the more conservative side in this country, to accuse others of living in the past, but there you go. To the rich with unchecked power, there should be a threat, always. But even when it is not, they know how to spin a good yarn about such things that don't really exist. But also, I think there is some psychological issues happening here too. Someone mentioned a theory recently. It was Matt Crisman from Chapo Trap House, in relation to the spate of police incidents in America, where officers were claiming that they were experiencing disrespect or harassment in restaurants or similar places, claims of staff poisoning their soft drinks or putting things in their burgers, that sort of thing, all of which pretty much turned out to be lies, completely invented. Crispin said that he thought this was due to them ultimately at heart, if they have one, feeling, knowing even, that while there was this wasn't actually happening, it was the kind of thing that they actually deserved. The police were essentially inventing a persecution they knew was coming to them, but it never actually did. Now, I think that's a very interesting idea, and I think it can be extended not just to the police here in Britain, but also to many within our society, but specifically those that are rich or aspire to be or are well off and secure in some way or another, particularly in a society where so few people are secure now, be it with housing or work or expectation of any kind of wages. Where we know, for instance, that there is no way of becoming rich without hurting others and ultimately society, this is partly why the richest in our societies, usually with inherited wealth, tend to lack any kind of empathy or human decency. They are closed off and cold and often institutionalized from a very early age to believe that they must dominate their class inferiors, and humiliation is a major factor in all of this. While, as ever, the middle class seek to copy the behavior of these awful people who they have always looked up to and have always wanted to be. That is, again, what's bred into them as a class. So, tied to this, but more dominant in the next level or so down from that, is that we have the obsession with others earning their position in some way while convincing yourself that you have without any shadow of a doubt. This is where inequality is given justification for the idea that those without simply have not worked hard enough, like you have, running whatever weak small business that you inherited from your dad, or filling up an office space with some bullshit management position that could be dispensed with tomorrow and nobody would notice. Nevertheless, this is where you stand your ground and claim that those on benefits are all lazy, et cetera, et cetera. This is a world where discussion is always about the rights of property over the rights of the person. This is all getting worse with low wages, no matter what governments claim, or this particular government claims. Landlords buying up housing and the ultra rich using it as an investment. We see more and more people struggling with no real interest in changing this because too many with access to the levers of power, including those maintaining cultural norms and notions, are determined to push this system even to breaking point. All of this mindset involves, is what I would characterize as conservative to a greater or lesser extent in some way, you know, or in other words, small c or big c, depending on how you want to look at it. So yeah, to a greater or lesser extent, they're relating to the ways of thinking, either keeping things the same or maintaining a sharp social order to believe in people exist on scales of worthiness in some way. This, however, has become far less easy to justify in recent years, which I certainly think is a step in the right direction. While we exist in the worst of times in so many ways, we can in fact see great strides in some cases. We're seeing younger people respond to a grossly unfair world by demanding not only their own rights, but those of complete strangers around the world who suffer the fallout from Western greed. We see demands to unionise workforces in the most effective manner seen for decades. Plus, even though Britain's royal-obsessed media seem to have ignored this, a few weeks ago it was announced that the Queen supports Black Lives Matter. Now, let's be clear on this. I could actually care less what any of the royals think. And even if she does, I fail to see what real difference that's going to make, especially in a family as racist as the Queen's. Nevertheless, this is politically quite a move from a figurehead who rarely expresses any kind of opinion on public issues like this and cuts against the general consensus of the vile media that plagues this country. It should be pointed out that this would not have happened, could not have happened, without the unrelenting campaign at the heart of Black Lives Matter. It's really telling to me. I don't know if you, we'll come back to this when I get near the end, Dave, but I'd be interested in your view on this because it's really telling to me that this has been announced. I'm sure you probably remember it. I certainly remember it, that this little footman came on TV and was saying the Queen supports Black Lives Matter. And it was easy to ignore because he was the usual kind of royal, lickspittle type. But it's almost like it's been completely forgotten. It's the one kind of royal issue where the press have gone, oh, yes, well, never mind, let's just move on. What did Meghan do yesterday? You know, that kind of thing. But it's I think it's probably of more relevance than it's been given credence to. But anyway, we'll come back to that later. So the present Conservative government has been forced during the pandemic and now within the failures of Brexit to enact a huge state policy of economic management and care. This is complete anathema to neoliberalism, which has been the dominant order throughout the last 40 years or so. This is against that particular economic religion that has united Conservatives and Liberals or centrists throughout the majority of most of our lives. Things are changing and this worries the powers that be. So obviously there is a need for them to snap back and get into this upon us. Now, while I would never suggest that Conservatives only have any kind of humanity or empathy, they do have an acute fear of any kind of equality, which they share with the wider middle class, knowing, among other things, that equality would prevent them from being seen as special anymore. With this in mind, I think the combination of needing to lie and exaggerate to beat your enemy, plus an awareness of your own greed and immorality, leads to an obsession that the right and the centre have with things like gulags. The idea of the left getting into power and applying a mild amount of social democracy, such as progressive taxes, for instance, leads to wild claims of rounding us all up to be dispatched to some kind of forced labour camp merely when asked to pay a proper amount of tax, or to stop polluting the world to the point of destruction, or to set a standard of housing fit for human habitation. Apparently, this is all completely out of the bounds of political acceptability. This is some kind of social indecency which we're forcing upon, you know, good, decent, upstanding landlords, or, you know, mum and dad landlords, maybe, whoever they are. And it even infects understanding of the real world, very much infects understanding of the real world, despite being incredibly immature and stupid. During COVID and the Brexit shortages we've had so far, we have seen endless claims in columns and on Twitter with centrist shrills and conservative scum answering pictures of empty shelves and queues of homeless people trying to get fed in the cold streets with, "This would have been worse under Corbyn," or "This looks like the last days of the Soviet Union." The, I think, arguably cognitive dissonance really in this is amazing. This is really right, the reality that is right in front of you, it's right in front of your face. This is the end of capitalism under an uber-capitalist government allergic to responsibility. It is nothing like Soviet Union, and it is no possible way to actually prove that it could have been worse under Corbyn, or even that it would be worse under the Lib Dems, if you like, although I'm sure it would. I really think that the reason for all of this is that people know that this is, again, coming back to the point I made at the top of this long paragraph, this is basically what they deserve. And they are playing this out like some kind of bizarre sci-fi, or perhaps even to some degree almost BDSM fantasy about being punished for being the bad people that they are. There's so much projection going on here that it's actually quite scary. The absolute demand for there to be no progress whatsoever, that capitalist realism is the only way, even if this is to the point where we all burn. All of this also intersects with another aspect that I think is worth turning to. The anti-vax movement. Now, we're going to delve into this in a bit more detail at a later date, as there's quite a lot I want to talk about in the anti-vax movement, specifically the way that the far right has taken power with it and in relation to denial of medical science, which is nothing new, sadly. But I just want to mention them in relation to one part of this discussion tonight. The main motivation that I see within all of the anti-vax movement and a lot of things relating to it, a lot of offshoots, a lot of COVID denial, particularly, I suppose it all comes under exactly the same umbrella. I suppose actually anti-vax comes under COVID denial, really. So I suppose that's the big ideological umbrella. A major factor of the centre to right ideology is a total unwillingness to do anything for others. It is a complete commitment to total self-centeredness, a hatred of the people and of any politics that represents the majority best, which usually hides within the flaky concepts of libertarianism. Selfishness as a full-on mental breakdown and political ideology all at the same time. It's quite overwhelming. In fact, it's so overwhelming that many who might not consider themselves inclined towards the far right, although who have benefited plenty from white supremacy, will capitulate because they are so engulfed by greed and selfishness that ultimately they don't really care who's running the show as long as they can do whatever they want and never have any responsibility for what they do. It really is. It strikes me as something that's almost easy to ignore because it's so immature. You know, it's so silly. But I think we ignore it at our peril. Now, I want to talk quickly about the death drive. I am not a scholar. on the death drive. Okay, it's something I've only just started reading about or helping to understand. You know, this is Freud's theory about the desire for human destruction or self-destruction. So I don't know how much of it is conscious or if it is a wider part of being human, the desire to destroy, whatever. Anyway, that's perhaps for another show when I'm actually better educated on the subject. But I do feel like I see certain elements of it within the kind of thing that I was just talking about. There are elements of the death and destructive desire at work today, which, when they are displayed by the powerful, are destructive to all of us, which is why this matters. They are also dangerous for any daily interaction, for sure. But what really concerns me here is where the power comes from. As much as we might like to distance ourselves from those screaming twits running around Trafalgar Square without masks talking about tyranny, we're not actually as far removed from them as we might like, not least because of the same power dynamics that work in all of our lives. The desire within the death drive for the destruction of the present order makes sense to those like the anti-vaxxers and others in these supposed culture wars who think that they are rebelling against the present order while overlooking the fact that they are in fact advocates for it and for a far greater and more brutal application. This basically, or they basically have no idea or pretend not to what the present order actually is and instead pretend that we are awash with delicate lefties changing their pronouns just to annoy all of the old gits while ignoring the rise in hate crime towards trans people, foreigners and the like blighting this land right now. In reality, they seem to not even care. They just basically want to feel like victims. So I think it's another element of all of this. Being an extreme aggressor and yet acting like you're the victim all the time. Something that's basically fundamental to Israel's politics, among other places. This is not seeking for yourself to win, that is not to get any real related pleasure from winning anything, but in fact to see everybody else lose. That's the main motivation, that's the desire. At its most extreme, this is also what drives incels. Right now, these forces are at work in the Labour Party, as we've mentioned on previous shows, where the PLP and the leader's office are so obsessed with destroying the left in their party, they are not remotely interested in winning power and changing the lives of the poorest and the most vulnerable. If they ever were, to begin with, again, as kind of more middle-class, comfortable centrist types, I don't think they ever had any interest in changing this. And we know very well that their rhetoric can't be trusted. In fact, they're not even serious about benefiting the vote-swinging middle-class rump that got Blair into power, and don't insult my intelligence with any of that red wall crap. This is a group of people who are so self-absorbed and obsessed, they want to make a set of people they hate suffer for daring to rear their heads in the world of power, that despite impending climate catastrophe, increased homelessness, precarious work, and, a fucking great pandemic so mismanaged by the Conservatives that it led to hundreds of thousands of excess deaths. The PLP do not care. They just want to make sure that the left never get into power. And quite frankly, this obsession with making sure one group, whichever that group is, never gains any kind of power, regardless of the democratic mandate they might be given, is deeply unhealthy. And I think really quite insane. Their fellow management class leftovers are at work in France, too, where their political elite's addiction to neoliberalism has meant that the Front National are yet again poised to take power from the total failure that is Emmanuel Macron. Because after all, as white, mostly straight or straight passing people in France, or all of Europe or America for that matter, even if the fascists do take power, it's not really going to affect them materially. And again, this isn't a cheap diss, it's just something that I think is completely impossible to ignore when you're interacting with people in the wider society. The fact is that this is one of the reasons why such extremes were able to take any position of control and power in the first place, because for so many people, the better off to some degree or another, it just didn't actually have any kind of impact. So there's something of the desire for destruction here too, uniting the culturally political to actual holders of power and those aspire to do so. They want the world to be and or remain the way that they are comfortable with. And if not, it can be destroyed. It reminds me of something that keeps me awake quite often, actually, the unaccountable power of the billionaires willing to work us to death for their profit or burn us alive with their space adventures because they honestly seem to believe and act like they do not wish for the world to continue without them. This is what the unrestrained ego does when given unlimited power. I think they're deeply, deeply troubling times. Just the same as the culture war, anti-mask, COVID-19 denier would not admit to their chosen political enemy is actually right about anything, because this would be like a kind of mental death for them. They usually find out, however, with all this COVID denial, when they're lying in a hospital bed and they can't breathe, that actually the real death is substantially worse than the ideological one. Now, quick side issue here, believe it or not. Reflections and reluctance towards anti-fascism is what I wrote down here. It's something that's always relevant, but in the recent news that Britain First have been re-registered as a political party, it is worth discussing again. There's been some talk again recently criticising anti-fascist attitudes towards the lives of fascists. Lots of stuff about not declaring violent intent or recognising the need to de-radicalise people within these movements, etc. While this is most certainly an element of anti-fascist work, the de-radicalisation part especially, we must also recognise that where the money and the power comes from in all far-right movements is not redeemable. And that whoever they are, these people take to the streets with the full intent of attacking, harming or killing their perceived enemies. They show us no mercy and understanding, so I never have understood why there's such an emphasis from so many, supposedly on my side, to extend this in their direction. Okay, this isn't about some wanky middle class idea about being the bigger person in the fight. You're talking about getting beaten to a pulp at the very least, if not killed. You know, when that's actually happening in the street, which is something none of you have ever gone to, then it's really not a question of should I extend this guy a shaked hand and let's talk about our differences in issues. Okay. Also, there's the very thorny issue of moral equivalence. Well, no, it's not thorny, actually. There is no moral equivalence between the left and the right anyway, and there sure as hell isn't when it comes to fascism and anti-fascism. I think it's, again, immature and disgusting that we've been put in a position where that's actually been put on the table as if it's a sentient or grown-up idea. The simple fact is that many people are not active anti-fascists because they are cowards. Combined with the fact that this ideology of fascism, as I mentioned a minute ago, does not present them with much that would actually threaten their lives. They probably just get on with it. They're not willing to fight for this or anything for that matter. And they need self-justification for being this kind of person. So it's far easier to demonize the only real resistance with the usual condescending dismissals from accusing them of some kind of revolutionary romanticism to just say that they're actually part of the problem. Anti-fascism is, in fact, the only solution. Despite what seems some try to argue in endless bad faith, the tenets of fascism do not change. The boot boys of yesterday, who put on suits and went on the BBC news programmes, were no different. From the British movement to the National Front to the BNP to the EDL and Britain First, you still have overt Islamophobia, slightly less overt anti-Semitism these days, plenty of examples of homophobia. By the way, just made that underline the fact I said slightly less overt. I didn't say there was none there. Sad, we feel the need to actually underline these points, but there you are. Plenty of examples of homophobia, sexism, racism, and loads of transphobia, among other things. The fight has not changed, just the level of heart and soul many are willing to put into fighting this. Fortunately, so long as there are these repulsive people, there will be the real heroes of the varied and global anti-fascist movement who do not care what armchair hard men or podcast hosts think of them, who will not back down or embrace Hug a Nazi Week because it makes the middle class feel more comfortable. In fact, since at least the 1980s onwards, we have seen the stranglehold of the middle class over society. Their sense of entitlement drifts into all forms of expectation, be it within the world of customer service or just everyday life. And all of this takes place under capitalist realism. That means consumption becomes the only thing. I am a consumer and have more power within this realm. For instance, I might have more spending money than you do, so I call the shots. So protest becomes that thing that's annoying, the annoyance you see in the street seen to today, and allows the conservatives to remove our liberties, our genuine liberties, never mind wearing masks. This is about having the right to protest. Moving our liberties and removing our rights, because Mr. and Mrs. Average from suburbia find it all a little bit irritating when they go to the shopping centre and find people there calling for climate justice, calling for pension payments to be given to the staff of a local clothing chain that's shutting down, or holding the line against the latest group of pissed and coked up fascists trying to beat up anyone who looks a bit different that they don't like. Okay, so that was a hell of a lot of text delivered by my rather dry throat. I do have a conclusion, but I want to leave that for a sec, Dave, because I want to come to you and see if you can make any head or tail out of what the fuck I've just been going on about for the last 20 minutes.
You're an angry man, John.
I don't sound angry.
No, he's not an angry man. He's a lovely man. But it's interesting with my liberal head. And I'm not disputing it. I'm just interested. But the ideology that we're looking for, or what we're stating, and I say we because we're on Tracks FM and it's a platform, and it's great. Where's this ideology actually worked? Is there anywhere in the world? Now, we know South America, when Francisco comes on, we understand that why there's a rise in and it's not a dirty word, by the way. Socialist, I hate that word actually, John, but not left either. People friendly governments. I'm going to say that. People friendly governments.
That's a nice way of putting it.
I should stop using those narratives that the right wing media have us believe in. But
let's say people over profit government, how's that?
Yeah, which is how it should be. That's why they're there for. I understand the rise of people's governments in South America because it's a direct retaliation to US interference. Absolutely right. That's what happens. That's what happens when you interfere with these countries. This is what you get. Do I think that if they didn't interfere, we should have people-friendly governments? Well, when I'm no scholar. I'm not a great reader. Well, I do read a lot of books, actually. I'm going to lie. And looking back at the history of politics and why it was invented, it was a voice for people in Parliament to have decisions that affected them. That's really what they're there for. It's not anything elitist, regardless of how they would portray these people on the telly. They're there to represent you, the people. You're the experts. They've just got your voice. And I just wonder how far we have moved from that. Looking at some of the stuff you've raised today, John, how far we've come away from the ideology of these people represent you in the Houses of Parliament or Congress or whatever. They're there to represent you, your best interests. Am I naive to think, well, no, it's not like that? I think I am being a bit naive. From what I've read and the history and all that, obviously Mr. Guy Fawkes didn't agree with that ideology and blew it all up, or threatened to blow it up. Can't say I blame him, some would say. A little bit like the Big Brother house. Do they do that? Does that happen? Do politicians represent you, your constituency, in the air and say, well, I can't afford the rise in council tax? It's going to take me to the poverty line. I won't be able to afford my house. Does that person get in there and speak for you? I think we got to ask ourselves that question. I don't care what part of the aisle you're from. Don't bore me with that. That's just football tribalism. Don't sell that to me. I'm saying the history of politics and politicians are there to represent you, who probably work, otherwise you probably wouldn't be listening to anything if you didn't work and you were got a lot of money. Vast majority of us work and pay for tax, and then you pay or vote for these people to represent you. A good question. Do they do that? That is a big question. Don't answer now. You get a packet of Smarties if you get the answer right, John.
Is that not technically political bribery?
Well, Smarties.
Yeah, well, you know, you're offering it to the voting public, the listening public. I mean, I think that is a question that, do you know what, whenever this happens, and whenever I read back live what I've written, there's always a part of me that gets caught up in the, well, do I mean all people like this? Do I mean within this economic bracket, all people? No, of course I don't. But especially when you are someone with perhaps as limited a kind of expressive vocabulary as I have about these things, a limited academic vocabulary about where the intersections between class and you know, other aspects of economic position, like, kind of, these are the kind of boring ass fucking arguments I used to have in years ago when I went into public places before I abandoned that entirely. And you get people going, well, I've got a middle management job. I don't consider myself to be middle class and disconnected from it, all this kind of stuff. The fact is, it's very, very difficult to, if you open one, it's a bit like sociology. If you ask one question, you end with three. And that's important to understand the world as well. But also it means it takes a lot of grey matter. It takes a lot of grinding effort. Maybe grey matter is not the right word, you know, to kind of get to the end of this sort of thing, which is one of the reasons why it's so difficult. Whereas the right, of course, present the world as a very kind of simple binary, yes or no, black or white, rich or poor type of thing, which is very attractive on a basic human level, if nothing else, just for kind of understanding the world. You know, it's not my fault that I'm in this position. It's because there's, you know, everything from tyrannical governments wanting me to wear a mask to lizard people. Now, the other thing is comparative thing. Now, what you're talking about there, I think this is a very important thing to bring up. Do we live in times that are more or less democratic? Well, more or less compared to what? Now, if you're going to talk about, no one in here, believe me, nobody on this show believes in the good old days. But the fact of the matter is, as part of a political program, as part of an ideology-driven political program of governments over the last 40 odd years, things have become less democratic. MPs have become less accountable to you and me. Because of the way that too much of our society has allowed them to do that, they have actively become more accountable to big business, to corporations. There's really nothing. What I find interesting about the times we live in now is there's nothing, and I'm not saying we're dealing with this as well as we should, we're certainly not, but there's nothing controversial about what I'm saying. It's very, very simple. You can see it there. Where does the money come from? Where does the political power reside? Therefore, who do you answer to? More people, for instance, more MPs are likely to answer the call from Amazon in their local area if they decide they want to set up a local factory, sweatshop. They are not necessarily going to go, well, yes, you can. Some MPs might do it. Some MPs might try and do this, but where is, as I said, a bit of my example about what's going on with Labour at the moment, where is the backing to help them do this? Some MPs might put a line in the sand and go, okay, Amazon, you can open a factory here, but it has to have contracts that include X, Y, and Z, fair wages and hours and conditions, not overworking people. You have to, you know, set up this or the other or something else. And, you know, and you can't basically just come in and do what you want to. No, they don't. They just go, oh, yeah, great. Amazon's coming. It will set up X amount of jobs. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, away you go. We won't put any restrictions in because we're scared to death you'll go somewhere else. Or you'll leave the country entirely and go to, you know, some other part of the world and get everything done there and ship it in. And again, this is part of the real fear I have now of the way we've produced a world that isn't just a question of the rich versus the poor or the uber rich versus humanity. It's that you have companies like Amazon, like Netflix, whatever else, who can afford to lose money. Amazon can afford to lose shit tons of money. It's not going to make a blind bit of difference to them. Okay, most very, very rich and uber rich individuals can afford the same, but they tend to still be, maybe through training, you know, and conditioning, they still tend to be a little reticent to do so. So we're in a position now where it's almost like we have, on one side, as I've said in this show before, we've discussed it a few times, it's really great to see the kind of fight back of workers' rights, particularly from the young. But on the other side of it, it seems like we have less and less and less of a hand to actually play. And it's deeply upsetting and disturbing to me. And it probably is to other people too, whether they admit it or not. But this is also where you look at something like this, which you don't really have any power over. And you then also look at, let's have an argument about cultural things. Let's have an argument about cancelling, this kind of stuff. It's mostly bullshit, but more importantly, it's a distraction. And it's something to distract you from the true horror of knowing, among other things, the point you just made, Dave, do they represent us? No. The short answer to that, and the short answer is not really good enough, but the short answer is no. Politics less and less and less represents you and me, even though we're the people who are supposed to be directly involved in it. We're the people who are supposed to be producing the outcomes for our democratic voting ability. I don't know if that's half an answer at least, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that communities may need big businesses or businesses in the community to give people work. I get that, and we should encourage that. But is politics saying, well, okay, these people are going to get a job, and it's a good quality job, and Mr. So-and-so, Mr. Amazon, if you pay them accordingly with good terms and conditions, they're going to contribute to the main pot that we agree as a society. We'll all put in this big pot to pay for things that is a necessity. Gas, electric, water, and healthcare. And we all put our fair bit in. And that's the idea. Whether you're a socialist or not, that's a socialist principle. You may not like it, but it's there. Or people principle, or people-friendly principle, let's put it that way.
Well, also, just quickly, though, some of what I've just described, as I said, the present threat to the order that's kind of killed off neoliberalism as we understand it, I think. It's just a question of standing on its throat to make sure it's dead. Is exactly that. You've got a conservative government who have had to make massive public spending commitments because they were incapable of, the country was incapable of running without them because of the way COVID hit us on top of Brexit and on top of an economic order that was already under strain. So, yeah, I mean, and then so you're exactly right. That's the example I'm giving. You know, they have had to do that. And to some degree, it's no wonder that they've retained a degree of popularity despite being absolute mutants, because the Labour Party, as I said right now, want to punish their own side, and they're not interested in benefiting the rest of us, to the point where they're ignoring the horrors that surround us by going, we can't have the left in power. Everything that's happened now would be so much worse if it had been under Jeremy Corbyn. It's ludicrous.
Yeah, sorry, so the principle was in the 70s was some analysts got together and looked at how people can be more efficient. Are we producing enough output to export? Are trade unions stopping that output? And if for some reason it got diluted and it started to say, we want people to work harder for nothing. For some reason, the mathematics got wrong.
The philosophy. That's profit for you, mate, but yeah, go on.
And then it said certain people don't have to put in the big pot anymore, and certain people always have to, without fail, or you're going to jail. And then it got mixed up, and then it turns out that the things that we're meant to pay for, like the NHS, you know, for some reason, it's turned out to be a black hole because not enough people were putting into it, big businesses. And then they convinced us, well, if these big businesses have to pay tax, they're going to leave your community and you're not going to have any work. When I look back at the 80s, that's exactly what happened. And big businesses didn't leave. They were just taken.
Well, it was deindustrialization. They were actively shut down.
Yeah, and then it left communities without work, which traditionally became red wall or whatever they call it. John, I hate that word.
Well, I won't worry about it, mate, because it's a term that doesn't really exist, so we don't have to use it anymore.
Carry yeah, on. So, and it's not red wall. What it is the philosophy of politicians representing whoever those communities working, which are majority, stopped. That philosophy stopped, and it became more of bigger, earn more, and less contribution into that big pot that gives us all the things. And what they've convinced us to say as an argument, as working people, is, well, if it's free, how are we going to pay for it? And isn't it weird how we've turned that philosophy around? But it's up for debate.
It is, but this gets to the heart of part of what I'm talking about, which is it's funny, again, whenever I hear, and I'm hearing this more specifically for America right now, but I've heard it here plenty of times, this notion of the entitlement society. And it always makes me laugh, because where the hell do you think Cameron and Boris Johnson, the Bullington Club, come from if it's not an entitlement society? Where do you think those, you know, snooty, wannabe bourgeois bellends you might have to deal with in your job on a daily basis come from, where they just kind of have this assumption of the I have one element of this I often go on about, but I'm not bringing it into the show because it will make me sound truly raving if I start, because it just goes everywhere. But it's the idea about acceptable culture and acceptable music. You know, nothing annoys me more than well, a few things do actually, but culturally one of the things that annoys me the most is the attitude towards heavy rock music of various different types, whether it be various types of metal or punk or melodic hardcore, whatever you like. where there is the idea that this is, you know, this is just disgusting, appalling noise. Only the pop hits of the 70s through to the 90s should be played over and over and over and over again on the radio. And this kind of music, which has wonderful, whether you like the music or not, has wonderful social protection elements for its fan base, many of which are outsiders, whether they've chosen to be or otherwise. Usually they haven't. It has wonderful aspects to it. It's actually very popular and has made a lot of money for its particular part of the British economy, but it's never recognised in you know, the award ceremonies or et cetera. There's just an overriding social attitude, which I can't quite explain very well, which takes something like that and then, for that matter, anything else it fancies, and just kind of alienates it and labels it and decides that it's unacceptable. So I really should not have gone down that particular cul-de-sac because I can't remember where else I was going to go. I was going to answer your question directly about okay, no, sorry. So the deindustrialization, coming back to that, absolutely. You know, a political ideology that said big business rules, big government should not exist, hands-off economics. Absolute crap. They actively deindustrialized entire areas of this country. Now, again, as I've said before, we're allergic to nostalgia on this show. No one's going to make the argument about the good old days. But the fact of the matter is, as far as the amount of money that ended up in your pocket, as far as the degree of which you had some kind of political power in the real world, mainly through your trade union, mainly through labor organizing, this is the thing that so many of the things that are you know, reactions and responses and fightbacks to what's going on today, which is where a lot of the time they fail, despite having good ideals, is they don't have a full organizing contingent, mainly around labor, because that's the thing that still dominates all of our lives. Nevertheless, you know, you could afford a house, couldn't you? I mean, from our age group, Dave, most people have got houses. I mean, not as many as used to. We're the one that we are the squeezed middle. But, you know, the older property owners, that's the thing that defines them. It's not so much your age. It's, again, it's your class position. This is why we need class analysis. It's the people who are objecting to us who might be in the older age. There's plenty of great, you know, socialists and decent, upstanding people in the older age brackets, you know, even in the terrible boomers. But what defines them more is you've got people who are, you know, the property owners comparatively to the rest of us. And they're not stupid. They're looking around themselves and they're looking at younger people and they're going, blimey, they're having a rough time. But they can't admit that. Too many of them can't admit that, because there's something sort of culturally and politically unacceptable about saying you have a harder time than I do. And I'm more than happy to say it right now. You know, younger people right now, you are suffering in a world that I'm sorry, I haven't done more to prevent it from being created. You're having a much harder time than I did. And I had a shit time when I came out of school and started working. But you have it harder. And there's just a kind of an unwillingness to say that. There's a political arrogance and immaturity from someone to just actually admit that they're wrong. And you don't know what it's like. I grew up bathing in a puddle at 2 a.m. with my 14 brothers and sisters, and we all had to go to work for 18 hours a day. No, you didn't. You're lying. You didn't have to do that. What many of you did work in, however, was a political world with very, very strong trade unions, where labor practices were substantially better than they are now. Again, I'm not saying there aren't other issues involved in that. There were, and trade unions made certain mistakes in regards to their attitudes towards race and women in the workplace and LGBT rights. But nevertheless, you know, you had worker-dominated workforces. You know, the parts of the 70s that people don't want to remember is when the working class of this country took down a prime minister who was attempting to wage the same kind of war that one of his successors did manage to achieve. But we actually took him down. He said, well, we'll go to the country and see who's going to win this, whether it's going to be the Conservative government or the workers in the unions. And the fucking unions won. And that was wonderful. But yeah, sorry, I've got off on one then, but I think, go ahead. Oh, okay. I think you're away from the microphone. Okay. I think that is you see why I struggle with this. I've tied a very, very long tail onto this particular kite. Maybe I should be on YouTube instead of here. But yeah, it's all sounding a bit ADHD, but I don't mean it to. It is a coherent, active political strategy to make sure that certain, you know, economic groups, economic brackets, are the ones who, you know, take the most and give the least, and the rest of us have to take up the slack. So basically, we're the ones that have to earn the profit for Mr. Bezos while he gets to take William Shatner into space. And no disrespect to William Shatner, he's a man I like very much. But that's basically what's going on there, you know. Right. I suppose what I can do now is, well, I'm just waiting for Dave to come back, is, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will add something else I want to talk about very quickly before I go to the conclusion for this evening. Is I wanted to talk about something that was popped up on my feed, the Living Rent organization. It's tenant protection, which is something I think we should we're often looking for this in the positive on this show, so I think it's worth discussing. So in Scotland, according to the Living Rent campaign, which is has presided over a cooperation deal between the SNP and the Scottish Greens that has resulted in important new measures for tenants, including a national system of rent control, more protection against evictions, including a ban on winter evictions, and better regulation and enforcement. Now, as ever, of course, landlords will be working to water these things down, so vigilance is needed, but it's absolutely the case of grassroots action bringing better results. It would not have happened without the work done by Living Rent, who you can find at www.livingrent.org, and the great work that they've done. This is an example of things being, you know, actively taken up by the people who they concern, or quite often for the others, you know, for people for whom it concerns, etc. And it's a beautiful thing to see. It's that kind of thing that is now being done by organisations like that, which again could be done in a far more organised way through labour organising. That's kind of the point I was making. Sorry, Dave, are you back? Yeah, that's okay. No problem.
Trade unionists never switch off their phone. My phone
we don't switch off phones and we never sleep.
No, and I've switched it off now. Enough.
Which is why I'm rambling.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, I think we need a reset in society. We need to reset what we're about, what we want people who are voted in to do, what they're actually meant to discharge. I don't think we should be afraid of saying who you actually representing in there. We shouldn't be apathetic anymore. We have been for 40, 50, maybe 60 years on both, all political parties, and as a society, reset itself and decide what we want out of our communities or from our communities. I think we have a real big decision to make, especially with what's been going on. Do we really want the same old same? Are we going to, you know, during my life on this earth, before I make the great ascension, I'd like to see a reset politically and what these people, you know, are there to do, there to represent their communities, and stop coming up with this rubbish of how are we going to pay for that? Oh, we're going to pay for that. Where does that narrative come from? There is enough there for everyone to have a piece of a decent living, a decent home, food, free healthcare. These are the proud things this country should, they're very proud things this country should have or be proud of. I watched someone on Fox News, and it was on a Michael Moore film, where someone on Fox News said, we're going to end up like the loony Brits and have free healthcare. I mean, you know, and him actually playing that clip, he played that clip because he knew that he knows that that should be a right, that should be a human right. Gordon Bennett, John.
Yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant example. The kind of power that has been deployed through the politics that we're talking about and through the media as its extended arm is exactly represented in kind of what you're saying there. It's the idea of this resentment, as I said earlier on, this kind of, it doesn't matter if I win just as long as you lose kind of attitude. You know, oh, the very idea that you should have free healthcare if you live in America. But never mind the fact that that would benefit you and your family. It would make your life substantially easier. It would make your life substantially less stressful. What about the bloke down the road I don't think he's worked as hard as you have. He'd end up having free healthcare too. That's just appalling. And again, you know, the Conservatives and the Liberals are united on this. They're all obsessed with these metrics of measurement and who has the right to do this and who doesn't. And as for, you know, the thing you said there about the public finances, it's a great example. You know, again, one of the other aspects of the 80s that's another leftover to these times that have no capacity to create any new culture is this idea of the household, you know, the economic budget, the wider country's budget is the same as a household budget. No, it isn't. It's not the same at all. Okay, countries with power, particularly with interactions with their own national banking system, can produce money, can print money as and when they think it's the right thing to do. I know there's discussions about how that affects inflation and stuff like that, but nevertheless, you know, they can actually do that. It's not like a household. You're not borrowing it. You're not borrowing it if you produce it yourself. And yeah, the times we live in now, again, is what's the result of all this? What the result is all this fear mongering about not having enough money for this, that, and the other. Well, you've already got shelves that are emptying. You've got people who can't make enough money. You've got people who can't afford housing, can't afford to live. You know, more and more can't afford to live indoors. You've got all of these absolute complete calamities, not even mentioning climate change. And you're still telling me, no, you can't change this. And that's the, unfortunately, that's a greater level of power that they've managed to achieve, this class have managed to achieve, which is to convince us all that we're actually the problem. And whatever little we have, even when it keeps getting littler, is what we should be thankful for, and we should never, ever ask for anything else. Well, I agree to some degree. We shouldn't ask for anything else. We should demand it. We should demand better living conditions. We should demand better wages, and we should demand politicians who work for us, not work for big business. That's nothing to do with us. You know, you need to put big business in their place. You need to put corporations in their place. You need to put the rich in their place. They are not here to tell the rest of us what to do. Anyway, do you have anything to add to that, Dave, or should I just run the conclusion?
No, you run with it, John, before steam starts coming out of my ears.
I just want to say, just to give you an idea of where this comes from, and I don't know if anyone out there is, you know, like everyone these days, is an amateur epidemiologist or they're an amateur psychologist. You know, maybe you can piece together where this comes from. But I was thinking about the Gulag example I gave you earlier. The amount of times when you're talking to people about anything from, you know, reducing police powers to progressive taxes, you know, to kind of genuine bringing down the kind of real state power that doesn't benefit us as opposed to the state power that does. We'll be putting this in gulags next. You know, you on the left want to be right. That's never happened in Britain. You know, during the last period of time when we, from 45 onwards, where we had a broadly, I don't want to have an academic argument about this, we broadly had a socialist government. We'd have gulags. Well, not in this country anyway. Abroad, that's a different issue. But, you know, it's easy to ignore because it's so immature. And yet, actually, it's just this demented mindset that's convinced that it can create a, and this is even expressed by people in the media, so therefore they broadcast to others, you know, this demented mindset that thinks that they can create a kind of alternate universe where all of this is worse because the nice vegetarian man with a beard was in charge and not the absolute irresponsible, gibbering Bullington buffoon that you have right now. It's mad. And it's easy to kind of, to look at this and kind of go, well, where the hell do I go with this? And actually, after doing an hour's worth of show on it, I'm not entirely sure I've come up with anything entirely about where we go with this, except this needs to stop because it's nuts and we need to get into a better position. So, yeah, so I started with like kind of thinking about that and coupling that with thinking about these, you know, continual criticisms of anti-fascism and just thinking the people who are involved in that are, you know, are absolute cowards because they haven't got the guts to stand up to this because they know it won't really, you know, disinherit them of much power in the first place. It's really crazy. Anyway, that's how we got here. So in conclusion, there is no doubt that conscious political activity is happening here by those in power and those who feel politics and society should only represent them, with policies to reduce taxes or arrest people they don't like and pretty much nothing else. But I also think that there are underlying issues involved too that, among other things, are not always clear cut and in how they affect all of us, including the people involved within them. We must be aware of the unconscious desire to see it all brought down. It runs through so much of our culture, including nostalgia and the obsession with the past. I think the adage that's been attributed to both Frederick Jameson and Slavoj Žižek is actually very applicable right now. And it is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And that's the mindset that we absolutely have to break, because literally our lives depend upon it. It's perhaps designed to avoid future pain, but that's not good enough. It will cause that future pain, whether we like it or not. I do take great inspiration from younger people, from immigrants, and from the LGBT communities, among others, in their organising and their wins for people most in need. And as ever, I take great comfort in the global anti-fascist movement that will never back down in any fight thrown their way. Actually, in a week or so since the 85th anniversary of the Battle of Cable Street, I will still take inspiration and live by the decree of solidarity and no passerant. But nevertheless, we need to make these changes. We need to make them drastically. We need to make them now. Dave, do you have anything to add for the last 3 minutes, or do you want my Netflix recommendations?
You go for it, John.
No, actually, I was gonna phone you up and talk to you about this last night if you had a minute. I've just been watching that documentary about Nas and about the making of the Illuminatic. And it's interesting because I was never that big a fan of his. But it's a very well-made documentary and talks to a lot of people in that neighbourhood and where the inspirations for all of his first album came from. I often find that with a lot of music documentaries. I often watch ones, even if they're about music or bands I don't like. Like, I've never really liked Blur, with the exception of one album, but their documentary, No Distance Left to Run, is a really fascinating piece of work, and I really enjoyed watching it. And the Illuminatic one is pretty much the same. So I don't know if you've seen it or
you're like me. I wasn't a massive fan of Nas. I have become one because that's how good the album or his music was. Mm. And the thing with Nas, what I realised, being East Coast, he was kind of accepted, or one of the very few artists, even because there was a little bit of a row there with Western East Coast hip-hop. But he was seen at the time, and even more so now, as accepted as great hip-hop by both sides, even now. But even back then, he really didn't have any beef with that West Coast, East Coast thing. And now, looking at it, it's a wonderful piece of music, John.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. I just, at the time, I didn't really find, I was very, and everything that I was into culturally, I was very, you know, sort of, this should be different and unique and original. This time, I think maybe I just missed it. It sounded a bit like stuff I'd heard before. But I think I'm wrong about that, actually. Yeah, I think there's a lot more there. And there was a lot of this, not of that kind of combination of that underground sound that I think particularly came out in New York, which I really, really like. I like more in hindsight, as I think we've discussed before. You know, I go to those YouTube mixes and of 90s underground hip hop, and also picking up a lot on late 90s, early 2000s Def Jux stuff, which was, I got through again. I've kind of started with Run the Jewels with LP and worked backwards to the stuff we did before, but I'm really, really liking a lot of that.
Yeah.
It's interesting stuff. By the way, breaking news, Tommy Robinson has been, little Tommy Milkshake, Stephen Laxley Lennon has been, I believe, seems to be trending on Twitter that he's been found guilty of stalking. So another bright day for us.
What's happened with that gentleman? He's been dropped. He's been dropped by his masters. And that's all it is. It's the time to let, he's served his use by the elite. Not the elite, I'll tell you wrong, but served his use by the very rich.
Dave, I think you're right.
They've dropped him. They've dropped him.
Yeah, the funding for the far right always comes from the elite. Whether it's throwback to our first ever show when we talked about Jim Dowson, who funds so much of it within these aisles, to the Christian far right in America. Again, you know, just absolute wacky bunch who have the money in order to make their dreams come true, to the kind of, you know, fundamentalist Christians who claim they support Israel, but mainly because they want Jewish people to go there so Jesus comes back to earth and them and the rest of us fall into pits of fire. They're very, very scary people. But yeah, you're right. He's been used for what he was good for. It didn't really work out. He, you know, as is the way in our world of brief 5 minutes wonder celebrity, No one really cares about that if they ever did in the first place. So, like you say, he gets dropped. Don't need you anymore, mate. Off you go. You love to see it.
Okay, John, many thanks. Myself and John will be back with All the Rage next week. Thanks, John.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for sticking with it this week. Cheers, I appreciate it.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.tracksfm.org.